Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read. The cow goes...
St. Arthur, St. Selma, St. Paul, Sir, St. Cardinal, St. Plan, St. Giuseppe.
Hello and welcome to Bookworm. This is Michael Silverblatt, and today we've got a special show. What you've just heard is the opening chorus from the prelude of the opera Four Saints in Three Acts. It's by Virgil Thompson with the famous libretto by Gertrude Stein. My guest is Stephen Watson. He has written a book called Prepare for Saints, which is a narrative of how Four Saints in Three Acts, an extraordinary modernist extravaganza, made its way to New York from the ateliers of Paris, from the ballet schools of London, from the aesthetic avant-garde art studio of New York, and how all of these extraordinary elements combined to create, ultimately, the legend of modernism in America. Tell me how you started.
I first came to Four Saints in Three Acts really through my study of the American avant-garde in other ways. And I kept noticing that people would write about this in their memoirs, in their letters. Four Saints in Three Acts would repeatedly come up. And it was always talked about with a kind of reverence and excitement and enthusiasm that made it the touchstone of that generation. One of the letters, for instance, Constance Askew wrote to Virgil Thompson, "This opera does stand for the best period in our lives. I dare say we've grown old well enough, but it's not the same." And there is something about the extraordinary freshness of this opera. And the fact that this very revolutionary work could abut with the popular culture, that it could go from a modern museum to Broadway, which I think is extraordinary.
Well, here on this side of the table, you've got what you must imagine as a 15 or 16-year-old boy first learning about Gertrude Stein and wondering how to read her, really. And it wasn't until I heard the RCA recording of this opera, a recording that's only in fragments, really. It's half of the opera, that I heard the object that Gertrude Stein could make out of words. And it was so much fun to listen to. I've been listening to it on and off, of course, for nearly 20 years, more. And I love it always. And I think that one of the things that happens is that one comes to have affection for this kind of modernism. Yes. And I noticed that when you listen to Four Saints in Three Acts, there's something true that is not true of the work it inspired, say Einstein on the Beach or Laurie Anderson's work. Many other pieces are indebted to this really watershed collaboration. When you listen to it, you hear something tender and kind.
I'm so glad you're saying this, because it's absolutely both difficult and also embracing and romantic and affectionate. I mean, I always feel a kind of internal smile when I'm listening to this. and I put it on all the time.
Well, Virgil Thompson says that for him, composing the opera was nostalgia because he made it out. He was an organist as a young man in Southern Baptist churches, and he made it out of counting rhymes and church hymns, just as Gertrude Stein had made it out of bits of doggerel, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, all good children go to heaven. This was, in a way, a piece made out of trinkets.
Yes, yes, and specifically kind of late 19th century trinkets. You know, it's very interesting, this essential work of the 20th century, and yet I think both Virgil and Gertrude draw on many of their childhood associations.
Since our show is primarily about literature, the Gertrude Stein text, I wanted to talk a little bit about Gertrude Stein herself and the origins of Four Saints and Three Acts. My guest is Stephen Watson. His book is Prepare for Saints, published by Random House. And in many cases, just as your book is a story of how the production was preparing the production, Gertrude Stein's libretto, thrillingly, is most modernist in that she talks about writing it.
Yes.
In fact, at a certain point, obviously someone has come by, maybe Virgil, and said how much of it is finished. So she writes an aria, to be asked how much of it is finished, to be asked how much of it is finished, to be asked Saint Teresa how much of it is finished. Well, Saint Teresa is her lead character, and like any author who believes in characters taking control of the text, how much of it is finished? Ask Saint Teresa how much of it is finished. And the opera proceeds in this way. She's writing a play, and what are plays? Plays are structures of numbers, act one, scene one, scene two, act two, and all of this play becomes a play about numbering. How many saints are in it? How many acts are in it? How many scenes in each act? Which saints in which scenes? The structure is really the numerical structure of theater.
Yeah, absolutely. And that structure in many ways replaces any of the conventional ideas you would have about a narrative structure for a piece in the theater.
Now, as you listened again and again over the years, as I have as well, have secrets opened in the text? Have you come to understand it in certain ways?
There are some secrets that have been opened to me and many that have not. I don't know. Maybe we should talk about the pigeons on the grass sequence, for example,
which is
certainly at the time was the section that became most well known and really entered the popular conversation. And this pigeons on the grass, alas, it's partially. I mean, I think there's a play on Alice, pigeons on the grass, Alice. I think that's there.
Alice Betoklis.
Alice Betoklis, who certainly was reading all of this as soon as Gertrude finished it. There's also – it's pigeons on the grass, on the pigeons on the yellow grass, the short, longer yellow grass, etc. And it's also a part about the grass is turning from green to yellow. There's an aspect of death that is going on. Just as there's rebirth, there's death. I think that it plays on that. She then goes on to, if they were not pigeons, what were they? It was a magpie in the sky.
Listen to it.
Yeah, that's a great idea.
Pigeons on the grass, alas.
Pigeons on the grass, alas.
Short long the grass, short longer, longer, shorter yellow grass. Pigeons large, pigeons on the shorter, longer yellow grass, alas. Pigeons on the grass.
If they were not pigeons, what were they?
If they were not pigeons on the grass, alas, what were they?
had heard of a third, and he asked about it.
It was a magpie in the sky.
If a magpie in the sky, on the sky, cannot fly. If the pigeon on the grass, alas, can alas. And to pass the pigeon on the grass, alas. And the magpie in the sky, on the sky, and to try, alas, on the grass, alas, the pigeon on the grass, the pigeon on the grass, and alas.
They might be very well, very well, very well, they might be very well, they might be very well, very well, they might be.
Well, you must tell me if you know. Let Lucy Lily. Have you any idea of who Lily and Lucy were?
I don't think that they are specific. I don't know that they're specific people. I think, though, that it both is playing on two wonderful women's names. And the way it's set, it's almost – it feels to me like a flock of birds taking off. It feels like wings flapping and just things arising from the ground. And that's – I think one is free to make these kinds of associations. They're not – I mean, it's not as if that is the answer.
Yes, but it is interesting because I've been involved with Gertrude Stein plays. I directed one when I was – a much younger man, and most of the names I found in that play, which was called A Circular Play, referred to people like Mabel Dodge Lewin or Susan B. Anthony, or there's a section that refers, it just crops up. They said, Amelia and Susan said, we are refreshed by the news. And that is Amelia Earhart and Susan B. Anthony, who were heroines of Gertrude Stein's. You don't have to know these things, but what it's fun to know is that she's plucking things out of the air around her.
Yes.
That in her
yes.
interest of what she called the continuous present, the text is like a big tapestry of what she can knit in of what's around her at the moment.
Exactly. I mean, she compared this work in some ways to a landscape, this idea that she is in the middle of things which she can draw from, which she can see simultaneously. It's all of these things are out there in the landscape, and she orders them.
Now, I want to ask you, because more than any writer I know of, Gertrude Stein is given credit even for some sentences that are not her own, like when this you see, remember me. But a rose is a rose is a rose. And then Pigeons on the Grass, alas, which, as one of the critics of your book points out, even appeared as late as 30 years later in a Charlie Brown cartoon as
yes.
Beagles on the Grass, alas. How did these phrases make their way into the popular culture?
Well, first of all, it's sort of extraordinary that they did.
Mm-hmm.
I am frankly very surprised. I think that there is something that is very simple and pure about them that, allows them to be picked up, for one thing. I mean, one can say a rose is a rose is a rose. It's also very easy to parody it, and that's the flip side of Gertrude Stein's entrance into popular culture, because it's usually inverted in some ways as if it's all ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
But there's something about the sheer delight of this language that is both childlike and also entirely adult and manages to mix the two in a way that I think can touch a nerve that it doesn't depend on the context around it. It exists by itself like a thing in nature.
You want to know my theory about these things?
Yeah,
it's a peculiar thing. But I think that for Gertrude Stein, there are two kinds of perception that interest her completely. A child's perception and an artist's perception. Mm-hmm. A child's perception is a rose is a rose. An artist's perception is Toasted Susie is my ice cream. And what she's always interested in is how things can be defined, simply from the child's view, and then complexly in these vast, as they call them, catachristic complications of language. And it is the interest of seeing that the child's view is the mother of the artist's view, mm-hmm. that the simple one and the complex are balanced on the scales, not opposed. In between, there's what she hates, explanation.
Yes, 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 exactly, exactly.
But you say something that I'd never read before, that she compared understanding Four Saints and Three Acts to a football game.
Yes.
Could you tell? That's such a great idea.
Well, she says, you know, in general, when we talk about understanding, we're talking about putting it in some other kind of words. We're talking about translating it into something which is different than itself. And she said it's more like a football game. It is the play itself. It is something which exists in itself and does not need to be translated.
And she says that you don't translate football, nor do you have to translate me. You just watch it, and I suppose it is me because I made it, and that is the way I am.
That's right. That's right. She said, you know, people are always saying people don't understand Four Saints. And she said, well, that's nonsense. If they didn't understand it, they wouldn't listen to it. If you enjoy it, you understand it. And there is something that's both deeply felt about that and also, again, I think quite delightful.
Now, Virgil Thompson joins Gertrude Stein in setting Four Saints in Three Acts to music. And it began, this collaboration, in 1927. It wasn't until 1934 that the work had its debut in
Correct.
America, in Connecticut. Hartford, Connecticut.
Of all places.
Yes. And then moved to Broadway. A tradition, very brief, of operas on Broadway at that time. Mm-hmm. Not a long-standing tradition, but it made it one of the most performed operas in the world as a result.
Yes.
Porgy and Bess was the next one that had that kind of production. But Stein does not ask you to know where her language is coming from, although now and again it shows. We can make a guess about mm-hmm. what's going on around her. She's more interested in the toy or the object or the scroll, the scenery scroll she can make from it. The same thing, too, with Virgil Thompson. He's taking bits of hymns and prayers and here and there, but unlike the other modernists, T.S. Eliot, say, or Ezra Pound, where in order to understand the work, you must go to the place and research the quotation.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't really care, just as Gertrude doesn't, about whether you recognize the allusion. And even if you do, it is not meant to take you very far outside the work. In this is Gertrude Stein and Virgil Thompson's rebellion
mm-hmm.
against the academic modernism that was going on.
Absolutely. And Virgil very clearly felt that modernist music had come to a kind of dead end, that you couldn't get more dissonant or more fragmented. There's two things. That was his ideological position. And the practical position was, in a sense, he felt very clearly that what you needed with Gertrude Stein's words was music to make it run along, to make it clearer, more lucid, to set the American sound of her words. He said, otherwise, you know, if you tried to do something that's complicated, it would be like throwing sand in a gear. And he wanted to oil that gear in a way.
Now, in your book, Prepare for Saints, published by Random House, by my guest, Stephen Watson, you will let to give us a history of the production of the play, the people who funded it, the fashions that it spawned, the meeting points of Harvard and homosexual societies
yes.
that arrange for the presentation of such a difficult work, and you choose not to examine the piece for meanings. Now, I have a question here.
Mm-hmm.
This was always the way Gertrude and Virgil approached it, that one should not talk about the meaning of the piece. But why do you join them?
Well, first of all, I come to it from my own place. I am a cultural historian. What drew me to this was the fact that this opera seems to me at the absolute center of so many things that are going on at this crucial point in the rise of modernism in America. It becomes a window for looking at the Harvard gay mafia who really set modernist taste for, you know, a half a century.
You're talking about the founding of the New York Ballet scene, yep. the New York Opera.
The Museum of Modern Art.
The bringing of
international style
to
architecture. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Philip Johnson, Lincoln Kirstein, Alfred Barr. It's a very small handful of people that are both behind the opera and also behind creating the tenets of modernism that, as I say, really have stayed with us for a long time. It's also, I think, you know, before anybody was using the word multicultural, this is an incredibly multicultural piece. The collaborators including Jews, lesbians, gay men, WASPs, African Americans. It really pulls a lot of things together.
This was famously an entirely African American cast in an opera that was not about African Americans. They were all playing roles that have no color to
That's
their
right.
skin. The reason this interests me so much is that famously Richard Wright, James Baldwin speak of finding Gertrude Stein's early book, Three Lives, finding the Melanctha section, and finding it the first place where modern black speech is recorded in America. And in so many instances, it's the text that black writers felt gave them a freedom. It crossed racial lines.
Yes.
It penetrated an aspect of life that had never been seen before, and certainly not in white American writing, and had barely made its way in truthful representation in black American writing. Now, from there to this stuff and nonsense, this really high camp and chic that surrounds the Negro
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
in Four Saints and Three Acts. What has gone on in the culture between those years that has made this such a strange, exotic object?
Well, first of all, when you're talking about Three Lives, of course, that's the very beginning of the 20th century. We're talking now about end of the 20s, early 30s. In the interim, there has been the so-called New Negro period, the Harlem Renaissance, the period of going uptown to Harlem, which begins about 1924 and hits its peak about 1928. There's a whole different awareness of black life in America, but it's equally fetishized. I mean, I want to be very clear that there's new stereotypes. The stereotypes are of black people having a kind of spiritual abandon, a connection to their bodies that white people don't have, the sense that black experience and black culture is more authentically American and not infected by European culture. This is a period when we're very interested in discovering what's American. There is much more direct contact with black people. And so all of this kind of gets thrown into the stew, and there's a new set of stereotypes that come out in the late 20s and certainly into the early 30s. They're mostly not political in any overt way. They more relate to the physical characteristics, the beauty of black people, the sense that they're closer to spirituality, they're more capable of responding to a religious subject. So all of these things, which, you know, casting Four Saints entirely with African Americans was both a revolutionary act and an act that was completely suited to the times.
It's Thompson's great intuition, really, that what he likes is the purity and clarity of the diction.
Yes.
That they bring to the words of the song, and that one could hear in the black masses and hymns an enunciation and warmth that one would not have heard in other choirs.
Yes.
And that is the thing that lives when we listen to Four Saints in Three Acts. I wanted us, before closing, to hear the end where, almost in celebration, the chorus declares, "Last act, which is a fact." My guest is Stephen Watson. The book is Prepare for Saints.
And left and right, laterally, be lined.
Four Saints in Three Acts. My guest has been Stephen Watson, the author of Prepare for Saints, Gertrude Stein, Virgil Thompson, and the Mainstreaming of American Modernism, published by Random House. Thank you for joining me today, Stephen.
Thank you, Michael.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer is Jennifer Swadek. Special production assistance today from Alan Howard. Development by Beverly Walker. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is made available to the public radio system by SAS, a satellite service of KCRW Santa Monica. Cassette copies of this and other Bookworm programs are available. For ordering information, call KCRW at 310-450-5183.
Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasure, friends in prose and rhyme.
Now it's Book of the Mouse Club time.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.